Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 28th, the year 2000, and in the Creekside, or I should say the Fireside Room this morning, Rabbi Robert Marks continues his series, and this is the final one, Clear Away in the Wilderness. And today we're talking about David, Bathsheba, and the beginning of the prophecy. This is tape number MXR 2008. So now let's join the rabbi for today's Bible study.
Tadonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who has sanctified us by thy commandments, commanded us to study thy word. Today I'd like to deal with one of the most exciting and also one of the most difficult parts of the Bible, one of the most challenging for us to understand. I'm going to need for this three good readers with loud voices, and I would like to be able to have some hands up of three people who would like to do one, two, and I saw some, well, which, okay, three, all right, real loud, real good and loud, okay? I'm looking in two directions simultaneously. At the end of his life, Moses is only able to look over the promised land. He's not able to reach it. He sees a vision. He sees the land. Those of you who have been in Amman, Jordan, can go up on the roof of a house in Amman, Jordan, and see the lights of Jerusalem in the distance. You can see them. It is not that far away. And Moses was so close, and yet so far. I want to read the account of his death and then talk a little bit about what changed and why things changed that were to create a type of Judaism that was unimaginable at the time of Moses. We started this course last week, for those of you who were there, with the words Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, Bereshit bara, in the beginning God created. And now we're at the end of the five books of the Bible. We're at the end of what we call the Torah cycle, and we see Moses about to die. Now let's have our first reader read that death of Moses scene from Deuteronomy. Now there are two translations of the same passage on your text. I would prefer, if you're able to, with your eyes, to read the center one, but otherwise you may follow along with either the one on the center column or the one in the left column, whichever one you would prefer.
And Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, that is over Jericho, against Jericho. Then the Lord showed him all the land, even Gilead as far as Dan, and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim, and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah as far as the Hinder Sea, and the south in the plain, even the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. And the Lord said unto him, this is the land which I swore unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he was buried in the valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor. And no man knoweth of his sepulchre until this day. And Moses was 120 years old when he died, His eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. And the children Israel wept for Moses in the plain of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and the mourning for Moses were ended. And Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom. For Moses had laid his hand upon him, and the children of Israel hearkened unto him, and did as the Lord commanded Moses. And there hath not arisen a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face in all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh, and to all servants, and to all his land, and in all the mighty hand, and in all the great terror which Moses wrought in the sight of Israel.
Okay, thank you. Now, you have read the death of Moses. According to Jewish tradition, this whole Bible, this whole Torah, was written by Moses upon the instruction of God. Moses, you will recall, goes up into the mountain. He spends 40 days there. And God is dictating to him the words of his Torah. And Moses dies. How can we account for the fact that Moses writes the story of his own death? Tradition says two things. One is that God wrote the description of his death. God himself or herself wrote this description of the death of Moses. And since this is a Jewish argument, there has to be another point of view, and that is that Moses was with God. You can tell it's time for me to leave. That Joshua was with Moses and wrote down, am I sure? No. One is never sure. When one reads the Midrash, you can never be sure. That Joshua writes down the last words of Moses' life, and Moses died. Now tell me, what are the things that you see in this passage that you just read, you know, that might be interesting to point out about a great person dying? What do you see? Yes.
Well, he's described as being healthy when he dies.
Very healthy. Well, he's whole when he dies. There's not a long period of sickness. So that Moses is in the full vigor of his life when he dies. His eyes are undimmed. Okay. He's a pretty strong guy. What else do you see about the death of Moses in this passage that you've just read? Okay, I can't see upstairs, so.
But many people mourned. The nation mourned.
The nation mourned. Okay? A lot of people mourned for him. What else?
Moses was completely calm about the whole thing.
Moses was calm. In this passage, Moses was calm about the whole thing?
He doesn't tell us.
Okay. What else? Anything else?
His grave is not known where he's.
His grave is not known. I mean, you don't. And that's characteristic. You don't worship at his grave. There's no place where you can come and make Moses a god, right? In this tradition. Nope, no place. Anything else you want to talk about?
Well, what a neat thing to be called when you die, a servant of God.
A servant of God. He's a servant of God. Good. Note that in this tradition, in this story, there's something missing. Moses doesn't go anywhere. Doesn't go up to heaven. He doesn't go anywhere. Moses simply dies. It's as simple as that. Now you've got to know that in this Jewish tradition, until very late, there simply was not an afterlife. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. I want you to know that heaven was simply a physical place. It wasn't a place where people go to when they die. When Abraham dies, when Sarah dies, she's buried in a grave. The important thing is what the grave is going to cost. There's a bargain. between Machpelah and Abraham over what the grave is going to cost. And in typical Near Eastern fashion, one says, I want to buy it, and the other says, I don't want to buy it. And one says, I want to buy it, and the other says, I don't want to buy it. And one says, I want to buy it, and the other says, I don't want to buy it. And he says, what's 200 shekels? Okay. That's how it works. Now, in the Bible, when a king does an evil thing, King Jehu did evil in the eyes of the Lord. King Jehu slept with his fathers. Slept with his fathers. No heaven. No afterlife. They died. One of the key elements in this process is that man and God, human beings and God, are separate from one another. There is no even indication of the essence of life. Well, it appears in the story of Noah, where after the flood, you'll recall, Noah is allowed to eat meat for the first time. Meat. Before Noah, what human beings eat are prescribed in Genesis and described there. You can eat the trees, the fruit of the trees. You can eat anything that groweth out of the ground. But you can't eat animals. Nowhere does it say you can eat meat, if you read that very carefully. But by the time of Noah, after the flood, God says to Noah, you can eat meat. Only you cannot eat the blood thereof. Ki hanefesh hi hadam. Because the soul, that is in the blood, or that is the blood. That is the blood. How fascinating to me that in Judaism and Christianity, blood should play such a critical role in dividing the two faiths. Fascinating to me. In Judaism, you don't eat the blood. At the Passover Seder, Jesus is described as coming to Jerusalem, and he participates. The first thing he asks is, where are we going to celebrate the Passover? And there is a Passover Seder arranged for Jesus with his disciples. And they sit down at the table, and according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus takes the bread, which is the Passover bread, matzah, that we eat at Passover. Jesus takes the bread and says, this is my body. Jesus takes the wine and says, this is my blood, and drinks the blood. That becomes the Eucharist, the bread and the wine. But sadly, that symbolism of the Eucharist, you know, I have to sit there and I can appreciate it, but I can't, of course, participate in it. Because that symbolism has become a key symbolism in the history of our two faiths. It's so fascinating that Jews who do not touch blood, the blood of an animal, we have to, you know, in a kosher process, to make meat kosher, you take the blood out of the animal. It tastes awful. It's sort of dry, but you know, you can learn to like it. But you better not go into an Orthodox Jewish home and order your roast beef rare. You will not get it. And you will not get it au juice. or juice natural. But during the Middle Ages, one of the accusations that was brought against the Jews was that they drank the blood of a Christian child. And this is a tragic, tragic chapter of Jewish history. Dan, you know about this? I don't know where you've gone, but I saw you. Yeah, right? That accusation, a blood of all things that Jews wouldn't eat, became the symbol, the accusation that Jews had killed a Christian child usually at Passover time. And if you want to read about this, read Heinrich Heine's short story, The Rabbi of Bachrach, in which this terror is enacted in a little town along the Rhine River, town of Bachrach, which I visited along the Rhine River, beautiful little town, where there was a blood accusation. Until as late as 1885, we have records of blood accusations that were very serious. and in the United and in all areas of the world, occasionally it crops out this ridiculous charge of the drinking of blood. And it's so fascinating that the very symbol that would become most abhorrent to Jews, the drinking of blood, would have been the basis for these accusations. So that Jesus comes to the Passover Seder and changes the symbols of the Passover Seder and thus creates the basis for the Eucharist. Now, the idea of heaven does not come into either into Judaism until much later, until much after the main bulk of the Bible has been created. I don't want to quibble, but the book of Daniel and Ezekiel has certain visions that could be accused of doing this. But the idea of a life after death, of heaven, to which people go, is certainly not to be found in the first five books of the Bible. But where does it come from? How does it come into Judaism? It comes from Greek thought. Now, just as Greek thought comes into Judaism in the first century BCE and the first century of the Common Era, so Jewish ideas and Christian ideas go into the Roman world into the centuries following that. There was a thirst for new ideas. And the thirst for new ideas can be easily understood. The ritual of sacrifice, which was what kept the temple busy, was passé. I mean, it was a bad idea.
That's
by the
one
first
BC?
What?
By 1 BC?
Well, by the first century BC. The first century, by 100 BC. You can see arguments against it. But what you see is Greek thoughts coming into Judaism. Greek ideas coming with force into Judaism. Greek ideas, and we're going to see what some of these Greek ideas are. But you saw Greek ideas all over Judaism. If you go to Israel today, you will see arenas in which Greek athletic games were fought. You will hear, and if you read Jewish history, you will know that around this first century BCE and in the first century, Jewish kids wanted to participate in Olympic games and in games all over in some of these arenas in Israel, in what is now Israel, would change their circumcisions. So there was no visible mark of circumcision. They wanted to do this. Circumcision was sort of an embarrassing old sign. Greek ideas were coming into Judaism. And what were these Greek ideas? The Olympic games, the games, the athletic games, contests all over the place. That was one of them. Another one was this exciting new idea of heaven, of another world. And here I have to get a little technical. Platonic ideas are coming into Judaism. The ideas of Plato. Platonic dualism is coming into Judaism. Plato had this idea that there was a world out there and a world here. That there was perfect world out there, imperfect world here. Perfect justice out there, imperfect justice here. Let's now read the description of Socrates' death, and you'll see how these ideas begin to be expressed. So if we'll start with Crito made a sign to the servant, we're gathered together at Socrates' last moments. Socrates has been accused of corrupting the youth of the city. What that means, we're not exactly sure, are we? Corrupting the youth of the city. Some say he abused them homosexually. And others, you know, which is a possible explanation. Others say that he corrupted the youth, and whenever a dictator wants to get rid of a free thinker, you can say you're corrupting the morals of the city. You can say you're corrupting the city. You could do that. Now, whatever it does, we don't know, but whatever it was, we know that Plato, from Plato's description, that Socrates had a lot of people who were sympathetic to him around him, because they're coming around him upset, sad, to know that he is about to die. So if you will, reader number two, read, Crito made a sign to the servant.
Crito made a sign to the servant who was standing by, and he went out, and having been absent for some time, returned with the jailer, carrying the cup of poison. Socrates said, "You, my good friend, who are experienced in these matters, shall give me directions how I am to proceed." The man answered, "You have only to walk about until your legs are heavy, and then to lie down, and the poison will act." At the same time, he handed the cup to Socrates, who in the easiest and gentlest manner, without the least fear or change of color or feature, looking at the man with all his eyes, Echecrates, as his manner was, took the cup and said, "What do you say about making a libation out of this cup to any god? May I or not?" The man answered, "We only prepare, Socrates, just so much as we deem enough." "I understand," he said, "but I may and must ask the gods to prosper my journey from this to the other world. Even so, and so be it according to my prayer." Then raising the cup to his lips, quite readily and cheerfully he drank off the poison. And hitherto, most of us had been able to control our sorrow. But now, when we saw him drinking, and saw, too, that he had finished the draught, we could no longer forbear. And in spite of myself, my own tears were flowing fast, so that I covered my face and wept, not for him, but at the thought of my own calamity and having to part from such a friend.
A very touching thought about how we mourn for people, isn't it? That we cry not for them so much, but for our own loss. We're losing a friend, a parent, a child, somebody that we love very much. Yes.
Nor was I the first, for Crito, when he found himself unable to restrain his tears, had got up, and I followed. And at that moment, Apollodorus, who had been weeping all the time, broke out in a loud and passionate cry, which made cowards of us all. Socrates alone retained his calmness. "What is this strange outcry?" he said. "I sent away the women mainly in order that they might not misbehave in this way."
Real good about women, right? You love that. Yeah. Boy, how things have changed, I gotta say. When the men go out and weep now, women stay behind and take care of stuff. Go ahead.
"For I've been told that a man should die in peace. Be quiet then and have patience." When we heard his words, we were ashamed and refrained our tears. And he walked about until, as he said, his legs began to fail. Then he lay on his back, according to the directions, and the man who gave him the poison now and then looked at his feet and legs. And after a while, he pressed his foot hard and asked him if he could feel. And he said, "No." And then his leg, and so upwards and upwards, and showed us that he was cold and stiff. And he felt them himself and said, "When the poison reaches the heart, that will be the end." He was beginning to grow cold about the groin when he uncovered his face, for he had covered himself up, and said, they were his last words. He said, "Crito, I owe a cock to
Asclepius. I owe a cock to Asclepius." How would you like that? Isn't that, that's so powerful. He said, I owe a cock to Asclepius. And those were his dying words.
"Will you remember to pay the debt?" "The debt shall be paid," said Crito. "Is there anything else?" There was no answer to this question. But in a minute or two, a movement was heard, and the attendants uncovered him. His eyes were set, and Crito closed his eyes and mouth. Such was the end, Asclepius, of our friend, concerning whom I may truly say that of all the men of his time whom I have known, he was the wisest, the justest, and best.
I love this description of the death of Socrates. It's very moving. Socrates dies. What's different here from the death of Moses? What do you see that is different?
It's public, in a sense.
It's public. He dies surrounded by friends. Moses dies all alone. And that makes a big difference.
There seems to be more dialogue going on, too.
There seems to be. Moses listens, right?
Yeah.
To God. And here is Socrates talking with his friends and ending up with a sense, I owe a debt. I haven't paid my debt. I owe the barber 25 cents and I haven't paid it for my last haircut. Today it would be, I owe my barber $10 for my last haircut.
Well, Socrates was poisoned.
Socrates was poisoned. But no one has said, you know, you got to say some more things. What about that poisoning? What about?
He administered it himself.
He took it himself.
Yes.
He took it himself. What else do you see here?
Before he took it, he had to make a prayer to his God.
Yes, but he couldn't make a libation. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Yeah. My eyes in the back of my head are shut today, so I, yeah. He wanted to make a libation to his God. But there wasn't enough poison to do that. You know, in other words, you have to pour out some if you're going to make a libation. That would have been a neat trick, wouldn't it? Take some poison. I'd say, I got to make a libation to my God, pour the whole thing out, and then drink what's left. But Socrates wasn't that kind of a person. Right? Anything else back here? What else is here?
There's almost this clinical description of the way that death creeps over.
There is a clinical description. Keep that in mind. For when we get back to Moses for just a minute. Clinical description here.
We get a little glimpse of what he was thinking.
Aha.
Just before he died.
And that is.
His head is rolling over everything he's done. Is he taking care of everything?
Right. Good. He's taking care of everything.
And he
talks
about where he's going.
Aha. That's the key thing, Dick. Look at that. Is there any of that in Moses? And Moses, you hear where he's not going to go. He's not going to go to all those places that are described. Look at here, but where is he going to go? That's the key thing that you have to see.
The other world.
He is going to go to the other world. Yes?
Well, the question is how much of his well-being is associated with the fact that he's going to another better place.
All of it. All of it. You have to see that in Socrates' death, Moses doesn't have any fear. Moses has no choice. And that's characteristic of the first five books of the Bible. God tells you what you're going to do, and you do it. Now, you argue once in a while, but very rarely. Abraham argues with God. 50 people, 20, 30 people, 20 people, 10 people. Then God walks away. I love that scene where God says, enough of this, you know. You can bargain with Machpelah about that cave for your wife, but, you know, I reach a point where it's off. But here there's no bargaining. Moses is told what the promised land is going to be, not for him, but for other people. But Socrates says, I'm going to a better place. Now that, you see, ties in with what Socrates was all about. And it ties in with the Greek thought that is coming into Judaism to replace the sacrificial cult, which is out of date. And it comes in around 150, 200 BCE. Long before Jesus, long before Hillel. And how many, you've all heard about Hanukkah, haven't you? The Jewish white Christmas. I mean, Hanukkah used to be a decent minor holiday. Now, it is true, as I've heard, that in medieval Italy, the gondoliers in Venice used to sing Hanukkah songs. But that's about as close as we got to Christmas until the 20th century. And Hanukkah became a major holiday in this process. But Hanukkah, I think, is an interesting. Do any of you remember what Hanukkah was all about? It's a very minor story from an apocryphal book, which the Catholics read more than the Jews or Protestants. And in this apocryphal book, First Maccabees, is the story of Hanukkah. And what happens is that the Syrians impose upon the Jews certain ritual practices. But what was really, and that's the story, and so one of the Jews, Mattathias, rises up and kills somebody at the altar And then the Maccabees go out of the wilderness and they fight against the Syrians, and then they go back to Jerusalem and rededicate the temple. But notice the story, if I can just elliptically go over Hanukkah. The story takes place in a little town called Modin. Modin is a backwater fundamentalist Jewish town in the country. And what Modin is really opposed to is these Greek ideas coming into Judaism at about 165 BCE. Notice the revolt does not take place in the city. It does not take place in Jerusalem. The revolt takes place in Modin, a little town in the country, where there is a group of people opposed to these Greek ideas that are coming into Judaism. And the first person, I remind my congregation, the first person who was killed is a Jewish guy. A Jew kills a Jew. Because he's too Greek for them. Now, Greek ideas come into Judaism. Jewish ideas then, 200 years later, go out into the Greek world in the form of Judaism and Christianity. And all because Judaism has become passé, in a sense, by 165. And it has an infusion. Not an invasion, but an infusion of Greek ideas. The Greek idea of immortality. So that by Jesus' time, no one is questioning immortality. No one is questioning heaven. This Greek idea, the Platonic dualism that we hear about, Platonic dualism, two worlds, the world of perfect justice, the world of perfect righteousness, the world of perfect love, Platonic love, and this world of body. Body and soul are the dualism that we all accept in this world by the first century. And Jesus and Hillel are all products of this. No one now is questioning heaven anymore. The big debate now is not about heaven, but about the resurrection of the dead. Because Jewish people say, and they're saying by the first century, by the time of Jesus, that they're saying that not only do we accept the Greek idea of the immortality of the soul, that the soul is immortal and will go to some perfect place, but it has to be coupled with a Jewish idea and perhaps a Babylonian idea that the body will resurrect. So the big argument in Judaism is over the resurrection of the dead. It's over whether just the soul will survive or whether someday the body will survive. Now that became the argument between Judaism and Christianity, if you stop to think about it. It was an argument within Judaism. Jews were saying, the Pharisees were saying, we believe in both the immortality of the soul and the resurrection of the dead. As a matter of fact, the Pharisees and the Talmud said, who does not believe in the resurrection of the dead has no share in the world to come. And I believe that was one of the central quarrels between Judaism and Christianity as evinced in the New Testament. Because you see, if you feel, I feel in this instance, the Pharisees are saying, we believe in the resurrection of the dead. And after Jesus, according to Christian theology, said Jesus has been resurrected, the New Testament being written 50 to 100 years later could say, you Pharisees are hypocrites. Why are you hypocrites? Because you say you believe in the resurrection of the dead. Our Jesus has been resurrected, but you don't believe in Jesus. You don't believe in the resurrection of the dead. Now, what am I saying? Why is this so important? Let me put it more clearly. Why didn't Jews believe that Jesus was the Messiah? You have to understand that. What was the difference in this resurrection idea? What was it that was key? What was missing? And you should.
The Messiah was going to be in this world.
All right, the Messiah was going to be in this world, meaning what? Let's make sure we understand what that means. The difference is a key difference that we have to understand. Jesus was resurrected, but nobody else. Jesus was resurrected, but the community was not liberated from Roman rule. For Judaism, the key element, ladies and gentlemen, would be that the Roman domination of the community would be ended and Jews would be in charge of their own destiny, and that did not happen. Now, that didn't mean very much to the Roman rule, for the Roman Empire, where Christianity spread. It did mean something for the Jews who lived in Palestine. It was critically important. They wanted their freedom. They hated the Roman oppression. They didn't hate the Romans, they hated the oppression. I have to say that because I think Jews didn't hate Egyptians, they hated the Egyptian oppression in Egypt. Jews didn't hate the Romans, they hated the Roman oppression. They wanted it to come to an end, and it didn't happen. So that the Jews living in Jerusalem and around about did not find that they had gained anything. They did not get their freedom. So for them, you see, for the Jewish idea of the Messiah was always that the Messiah would liberate the people, the dead would resurrect when that happened. So the idea of the Messiah is always postponed, always in the future. And that the yoke of oppression would be thrown off. Now that didn't mean anything outside of Israel, where the Roman Empire was fine, yes.
You said the Messiah liberated the people, then it'll be resurrected, but resurrection is a new idea. Can you say more about that?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You said the Messiah liberates people.
There are three things that the Messiah does. The Messiah returns to life. The Messiah is resurrected and resurrects the people.
So that notion of resurrection, heaven, is that?
Resurrection is different from heaven, from a belief in heaven. There are two things. There is the immortality of the soul and the resurrection of the dead. Two different things. Two different aspects of Judaism. Now, the Sadducees only believed in the immortality of the soul. They had accepted these Greek ideas, and by the time we get the Sadducees and the Pharisees conflicting with one another in the first century of the Common Era, the Sadducees, who were the priests of the temple, they want to keep the status quo, right? Always power structures, just remember this, power structures always want to keep the status quo. They want to keep things exactly the way they are. That's why the priests were very happy with Roman rule. They were the products. They were appointed by the Romans. The high priests were. That's why there's maybe an accurate picture of them. But you have to understand that they were the appointees of the Roman Empire, and the Pharisees, who represented the people, were saying no, that what is important is not the preservation of sacrifices, not the preservation of this old regime, of this ancien regime, but rather a new Judaism in which the immortality of the soul is coupled with the resurrection of the dead, of the resurrection of the dead. But the resurrection of the dead is a community thing. Again, in order to understand Judaism, you have to understand the importance of community. Through everything we've talked about for these last 12 days, it's community, community, community. It is the people who has to survive. That doesn't mean we're not concerned about the individual. And that doesn't mean to say that Christianity is not concerned with community too. But the emphasis on Judaism is always on the community. And when the community is not resurrected, when the community is not liberated, that means our Messiah is still in the future. Look at our Passover Seder. Passover Seder. We took out Moses from the Passover Seder. He doesn't appear. Only in Nouveau Passover Seders do we put Moses in when we want to tell a story. Moses appears, but in the body of the text, it's not Moses who was there. Somebody has asked me the question, what about Elijah? He rises up to heaven in a chariot. You know, that's very interesting about Elijah going up to heaven in a chariot, but we never find out where Elijah goes or what happens to Elijah. But it's very fascinating to me that Elijah becomes the forerunner of the Messiah. It is Elijah who's going to come and say the Messiah will appear, that guy who went up to heaven. And in that vision in Matthew and Mark and Luke, where Jesus and his followers go up to heaven, who do they meet? They meet Moses and Elijah up in heaven. They meet them up there. They sort of have a summit meeting, as I pointed out once before this past week. They meet together. And Elijah is going to announce the Messiah. Jesus asks, who is going to, the disciples ask Jesus, who is going to be the modern Elijah? And Elijah answers, he's already been here. And that is, of course, John the Baptist. So John the Baptist and Elijah play parallel roles in our two religions. It is Elijah that is at the Passover Seder, not Jesus, not Moses. Not Moses. Elijah. It is Elijah that we set a place for in our Passover Seder. It is Elijah that we open the door for and let the spirit of Elijah come in. Not Moses. Elijah. Because he will announce the coming of the Messiah. Let me pause for a moment now and ask if there are any questions of what I've done so far. Do you see how these Greek thoughts have come into Judaism? Do you see how they're combined with the Jewish thought of the resurrection of the dead? They weren't there in the Bible. They weren't there in the Bible. They were there in portions, in Daniel, and in certain visions of Ezekiel, but they weren't there, by and large, in the body of the Bible. This is an influence coming in from outside, at first resisted, and then totally adopted. Okay? Totally adopted. And you can see in Socrates' death how Socrates, through Plato's writings, sets the scene for doing that. Now, are there any questions? Are you with it? Do you understand what I'm saying? Yes.
By the resurrection of the dead, you mean the resurrection of physical body.
Physical resurrection of the dead. People will come back to life.
Separate from the soul.
Separate from the soul. But body and soul will be united. Judaism believes in the in resurrection, not in reincarnation. In other words, you don't come back in a different body. You have your own. My own beautiful body is mine for all time.
What is the Jewish thought about cremation?
Traditional Jews are very opposed to cremation because cremation destroys the body. But some of us have said lately, if God can resurrect the dead from dry, desiccated bones, then he can resurrect the funeral directors have invented this god-awful word. They call it cremands. It's an undertaker's word. Yes?
Regarding the other better world, better place, is there any sense in Socrates' death that if he hadn't have repaid his debt, that might have interfered?
I don't get that. I think Socrates, just being a noble man, is saying, you know, he's sort of settling accounts as he's about to die, and he says, I owe a cock to Asclepius, and Socrates is a good man.
I was wondering at what point then does it start to focus on what does it take to get there?
Well, that's later theology. You know, here in this early period, everyone is resurrected. Now, in the later Talmudic passages and in later Christianity, then you get the concept of reward and punishment, and certainly in Islam you get that. You get the clearly defined concept of heaven and hell. In early Judaism, it's very vague. It's very vague. And remember the bet. Always that concept of mainly looking toward the future, not concentrating. According to Jewish tradition, four people went up to heaven to see what it was like. The Talmud describes it. And of the four, one converted to paganism, one went crazy, one committed suicide. Only Rabbi Akiva came back sane. And it's telling you that it's very dangerous to speculate too much about this. Somebody else had a comment? Yes, Jan.
The idea that the kingdom of heaven is now, that is, it is possible to live in a just world. It is possible to enjoy the feast that is to come, at least partially now, is something that the New Testament, the Gospels, talk about. Emphasized in liberation theology, mm-hmm. is an antidote to the notion that poor people always heard, that, you know, you're poor now, but wait a little while, your reward is coming in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any similar kind of...
Absolutely, absolutely, right from the very beginning. This whole distrust of counting, I mean, that's what I'm talking about all week. The bet, don't count too much on heaven. Do it today, that open bet facing the future. I mean, that's why I started with that, and that's why I have it on the board at the end. You have got to do it now. That doesn't mean that there is not a heaven for you, but if you're going to depend too much on that, if you're going to rely too much on that, you're avoiding the responsibilities that you're talking about and you're talking about, you know what I mean, in this world, to make this world a better place in which to live. You can say, well, everything will work out in heaven, so, you know, God has intended all this. We don't say that. We say God has, we feel that God has given us a challenge in this world that we have to meet and have to face. Other comments? Yes.
Yeah, I think Christianity has really skewed individual salvation. I mean, I don't really see that much in the New Testament, and it took me late in life to realize that when salvation is used, it's usually in saving from, I mean, almost always from oppressive systems.
Yeah.
And for justice, and how we put so much emphasis on individual salvation. I appreciate being reminded again of the Jewish sense of community. I think that's the entire scriptures.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm going to tell you, I love to watch the fundamentalist programs on television. I am in my family will sit around and they'll want to watch Gladiator 15, which you'll see someday. You know, they'll want to watch these television programs where there's blood and guts. I love to watch the revivalist preachers. But at the same time, I'm always saying, what am I missing? You know, believe. Well, I want to say, act, do something. Because I just feel you can't be saved. I can't be saved unless I've done all that I can to make this world a better place in which to live. Now, I like personal comfort and consolation. There are moments when I need it. But I have to couple with that a sense that, well, here's the Talmudic passage. A man should act, man, woman, should act as if the world was created for him alone. And at the same time, act as if he has to save the world. And there's another passage. Human beings should ask as if the world were created for them. Carry that in one pocket, and in the other pocket carry, I am dust and ashes. I'm dust and ashes. Both of those. You know, that contrasting idea. That salvation for me is the salvation of everybody. You can't rest until you have that perfect world, which works itself out here. The other comments before I read this final passage? Yes.
I have a memory of taking a confirmation class to synagogue and talking to the rabbi, and one of the smarter kids raised his hand and said, what is the difference between Christianity and Judaism? And the rabbi answered, and it was quite stunning. He said that Judaism is about living on this earth, and Christianity is about going to heaven when you die.
Mm-hmm.
And it shook me. When I go back to the scripture to find out that isn't what.
Of course, and I appreciate you saying that. And if some of you may have heard me say that when I first meet with my confirmation class, I ask them what they think the difference between Judaism and Christianity is, and they invariably don't say something about Jesus, but they invariably say something about Jews don't believe in heaven and Christians believe in heaven. And that's the same type of approach. And of course, we all believe in heaven. And perhaps how we approach this world and this life is something from which we can learn a great deal if we were to talk to each other properly. Yes. Any other comments? Go back to Deuteronomy again, and with this we'll end today. Go back to Deuteronomy. I'm going to ask you one question. I have fun with this. Do you see any words? Of course, you're reading a translation of the Hebrew. Do you see any words here that seem redundant or repetitious or some or other out of place? Just take a look at the text that you have, the Deuteronomy passage, either one, and tell me if you see anything. Let's do it quickly because we are going to run out of time, and I got to catch a bus.
The land.
What about the land? What?
The land.
Where do you see? Give me the verse first.
Throughout the Deuteronomy.
Yeah, first verse, and then tell me what you're talking about.
From the beginning, from one, the land, the Lord showed verse all one. The land, the naming all the lands.
Okay. Yeah, but that's sort of a geography lesson. That's the mapping out for the Zionists, the future map of Israel. Nobody laughed at that. I thought it was... I mean, you don't have to laugh on cue in this. So applause, huh? That's what it is, Ellen. That's sort of spelling out for Moses and maybe for the people. But I'm not sure that's... You're saying that the words are redundant? The description is redundant? Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, comment. Finish.
They just died in the land. About the earth.
Okay, yeah, he dies in the lake. Just dies. Yes, good. Yes.
In the very first verse in Deuteronomy 34, it says, at the end, the time of your death, it seems obvious.
Oh, no, you're reading the Midrash. Oh. You're reading the answer.
Oh.
Which is very good of you. That's wonderfully brilliant of you, you know. Look at the crib sheets and then tell me the answer. Well, all right, okay. You've got the thing I wanted. I wanted to see if you saw some other things. But take a look at verse, what they're commenting on is verse 8. Take a look at verse 8 in the text. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plain of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping in the morning for Moses were ended. And that's the verse that they're coming on, because it has too many words. The Hebrew is Vayitmu Yemei Bechi Eva Moses, and there came to an end the mourning days for the weeping over Moses. Why didn't it just say the mourning of Moses ended? Mourning for Moses. The weeping for Moses ended. Do you see the problem? Now we're going to have our third reader read very loudly this Midrash about that verse, the redundancy of words in that verse, okay?
At the end of the moment, a heavenly voice was heard declaring, the end, the time of your death has come, said Moses to God. Master of the universe, remember the day when thou didst reveal thyself unto me in the bush and didst say to me, come now therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, and thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, from Egypt. Remember the time when I abode on Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. I implore thee, do not hand me over to the hand of the angel of death. Thereupon a heavenly voice was heard saying to him, fear not, I myself will attend to you in your burial. At that hour, Moses arose and sanctified himself like the seraphim, and God came down from the highest heavens to take away the soul of Moses. And with him were three ministering angels, Michael, Gabriel, and Zagzagel.
There are three angels appear in and out. They sort of come in like uninvited guests every once in a while into these texts. But there are angels in Jewish scripture and in Jewish church. They keep appearing. Go ahead.
Michael laid out his spear. Gabriel spread out fine linen cloth at his bolster. Zagzagel went at his feet. Michael stood at one side and Gabriel on the other.
Okay, thank you. Here are the angels coming down to take care of Moses. I'm going to finish this, okay? God said, Moses, fold your eyelids over your eyes, and he did so. He then said, place your hands upon your breast, and he did so. He then said, put your feet next to one another, and he did so. Forthwith the Holy One, blessed be he, summoned the soul from the midst of the body, saying to her, the soul, saying to her, my daughter, I have fixed the period of thy stay in the body of Moses at 123 years, now thy end has come. Depart, delay not. Whereupon she replied, Master of the universe, I know that thou art the God of all spirits and all souls. The souls of the dead and the living are in thy keeping. And thou hast created and formed me and placed me within the body of Moses for 120 years. And now, is there a body in the world purer than the body of Moses, in which there was never been an offensive smell, nor worm, nor maggot, nor any kind of vermin? Notice the explicit use of these words. They're not afraid to talk about the bodily functions. The body is holy in its offensiveness even. Therefore I love him, and I do not desire to leave him. Whereupon God exclaimed, Soul, go forth, do not delay, and I will raise thee to the highest heavens, and will place thee under the throne of glory next to the cherubim, seraphim, and other troops of angels. I implore thee, let me remain in the body of Moses, says the soul. It's been cut out. I implore thee, let me remain in the body of Moses. Thereupon God kissed Moses and took away his soul with a kiss of the mouth. And God, if one might say so, wept. I never fail to be moved by that description of Moses. I cry. I cry when I see it. But look at the change. Moses was buried. He dies. He was buried in the first account. There's no mention of immortality, nothing. And here in the second account, you see what has come in to both of our faiths. God kisses the soul away and weeps. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've been with you for a lot of days now, and I hope none of you, particularly you, the professionals among you, will feel that what I've done has been offensive in any way. What I've tried to do is build some bridges by understanding how our common roots come together and how they diverge in the most holy and blessed of ways. Yes, sir.
Those of us who haven't been here the whole time, what is the Midrash?
Midrash are rabbinic sermons, brief little excerpts of sermons around a portion of the Bible. And sometimes they're said with passion too, as you can see here. But thank you all. Yes.
I hope that I can speak for all of us when I say that we thank you for the excellence and the inspiration of your teaching. And I hope that you live to be at least 120 years old.